Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com. Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
What kinds of gifts do people appreciate the most? And what should we keep in mind when making our year-end charitable contributions? We'll explore these topics and more on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, December 11th. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will also have some advice on finding a lawyer and saving money on heating bills and answers to your personal finance questions. Call in with yours at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Are you still digging out of your winter wonderland in Eau Claire? I talked earlier with a guest and was told you got about 15 inches of snow.
Yes, I'm just finding new muscles that are sore this morning that I didn't even know I had, much less I was using yesterday to try to get us out of these drifts. Like my great-grandmother used to say, though, she was from northern Minnesota, and she liked this kind of weather because, as she said, it keeps the riffraff out.
And it makes us hardy, too, and all that. And speaking of hardy, an update from our mini pledge drive last week when we asked for year-end contributions just for the 4 hours last week. For this hour alone, Kevin, 459 pledges, which is outstanding. Our goal was 300 and made 500 pledges practically.
Almost, and that's extremely generous, and we're very flattered, and hope all of you who were kind enough to pledge during that hour are enjoying your free On Your Money Mini Money Booklet, 20 Money Moves, and we're very appreciative of your support, and even the listeners, and for people who've supported in the past, and we know you will support in the future, so thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so very much, and we will have more conversation about things to keep in mind when making our year-end charitable contributions coming up a little bit later during On Your Money, but let's start with gift-giving. Kevin, some recent studies are telling us as to what sorts of gifts people really appreciate?
All right. The Journal of Experimental Psychology, that's kind of an alarming title for a publication, had a study that was published in the Wall Street Journal, and they were tracking how people feel about giving gifts and how people feel about receiving gifts. And the notion is that if you receive a gift from someone, and it's apparently they're very well thought out, a very deliberately planned gift, the notion is that you will become closer to the person giving you that gift. And what they found in the study is that's actually not true.
So it's not the thought that counts.
Not the thought that counts. That's what people say when they get a gift that they don't necessarily like as much or weren't expecting. Is they say, well, that's, at least you tried. And they found that the person giving a very thoughtful gift actually increases their level of closeness to the recipient. But the recipient doesn't quite feel the same way about the person giving this very well thought out gift. What they actually like is something that they actually have asked for and said, I really want this. Give me this. I will feel closer to you if you give me what I ask for, which is a good overriding theme for just about any relationship you're in with another person.
So eliminate the guesswork and the surprise, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So what about regifting? Is that okay?
Apparently it is, and according to several sources, including American Express, which ran a study last year at about this time, and they said, and this was kind of ironic because a credit card company, you think they would want people to buy new gifts, but they ran a study and published it saying that 79% of people said, yes, regifting is actually okay. And those people were more likely to be female and likely to be younger. And if we're worried that this isn't going to be institutionalized, it's just going to be a casual theme, do not, because the Money Management Institute has announced that the third Thursday of every December, coming up on the 20th here next week, is regifting day. And you can go to regiftable.com to find out how to do it, what's considered appropriate, what's not, regiftable.com. And I have some personal experience with this at a holiday a few years ago with some people who may or may not be my in-laws. About 20 of us were sitting around this little living room and opening presents, and my mother-in-law opened up a gift from her husband, my father-in-law, both very nice people. And it was this kind of black and gold lamé jacket. And she opened up, and everyone said, ooh, and ah, and said, oh, geez, Mom, that's a nice gift and everything like that. And she kind of had a sour look on her face. And we said, well, what's the matter, Mom? Don't you like the gift? And she said, I don't like it now, and I didn't like it last year when your dad gave this to me, too.
So how? What do you do? Go in the closet? And anyway.
Went out and got it back out, gave it to her again, and he chuckled. He was really enjoying himself.
That is hilarious.
Enjoyed that warm family moment.
Well, something you don't want to, something that distinctive might not be the thing you want to regift. But regifting, certainly there are things that you might receive that you never use, and you know somebody else would really like it. Why not? Anyway, what about kids? Do kids feel the same way about giving and receiving as adults?
Well, I am a parent, and I was a kid at one point. And my suspicions were confirmed by a recent anecdote of a preschool in Ohio where the administrator of the preschool took out all the toys that the kids were all playing with and just had some extra boxes lying around and said, well, you kids can play with the boxes instead. And they found that the kids actually liked the boxes more than they liked the toys. And they found that the kids, some of the kids who were dominant in the class actually kind of receded a little bit. And some kids who maybe were a little quieter expressed more creativity and more ownership of these boxes that they were cutting up and taping and making into all sorts of different projects here. And the kids haven't complained. So try this yourself. If you don't believe me, give a kid boxes within boxes within boxes. Go to some, you know, local department store, see if they can find any boxes that way, and put some tape in there and some scissors, and leave that out after all the presents are open. And I bet you by the end of the day, the boxes are probably played with more than the actual presents. And one of the best things for large boxes you can build is, of course, a fort. And especially when it's inside and the weather is like this. So we've got a couple different forts that you can purchase at Amazon.com. They're very popular right now. These are usually like small PVC tubes and couplers and fabric that one can use to just kind of construct whatever they want from a fort. But a couple highly rated ones at Amazon.com, about $25 to $100 or so. But again, they're going very fast, and we'll put links up to those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Forts are awesome, so that's excellent. And later on,
at your age, I know the good people at Wisconsin Public Radio, if you got 10, 15 minutes, they all head over to the break room and say, hey.
Yeah, we have blankets up over the chairs and stuff.
Build a fort? Sure, yes. No problem.
Now, a little later, we are going to be sharing a website of the week. Is that going to be shopping or gift related as well?
Absolutely. All season long here, we are putting up websites of the week that will hopefully help you find interesting gifts for people and gifts that they really want and increase your level of closeness to them. And we have a very special one later on this afternoon.
So stay tuned for that. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, who's here to answer your personal finance questions. And maybe along the way, we can have a little bit of fun, only if you recall regifting, maybe, or an unusual gift you've ever received, maybe one you didn't ask for. We'll just have a little bit of fun with this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investors. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any financial decisions. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And this week we have not one, but two emails from listeners, both offering some useful information for other listeners. The first one is from a lawyer who had plenty of compliments for the show, so thanks for that, but would also like to add a few alternatives to looking for an attorney at lawyers.com. She suggested that we tell listeners about Find Law, AWO, Justia, and NOLO. I'm not sure I know what all those are, Kevin.
Well, she made some great points, and she said that, and we've done this in the past, one of the quickest ways for people to find a lawyer when they need one is lawyers.com. But many of these different sites, and not just for lawyers, have paid listings, which tends to skew some of the results toward the people who bought the advertising. That's the business model because it's free usually for the consumers. And oftentimes there's either advertising on there or people pay to have a more prominently listed notification on the actual website. And that doesn't make them necessarily bad lawyers. It just means it makes it a little harder to find ones who haven't paid up there. So these other sites, Find Law, AWO, Justia, and NOLO, tend to skew more toward people who are just a general listing of actual attorneys. And it's a great point, but it's one of many methods you can use to find a lawyer when you need one. Others are talk with a CPA or a financial advisor. And even if you have a friend who's an attorney and say, do you do this kind of work? And if you don't, do you know someone who does who you could recommend? And usually most attorneys will have a free initial consultation where they will tell you not only if they can help you, but how they would help you and what you might expect to pay. And then you can decide if you want to use them for your various legal services.
Yeah. Well, let's say we've set up our will and things like that. How often do we check in with an estate planning attorney?
There's a couple of triggers I would consider. One is if there's a change in your life situation, and a significant one, like a marriage or a birth of a child or a death in the family, or if you're obviously going through a divorce, or any change in estate laws. And that's very tricky right now because technically the estate laws could be very different now on from now versus January 2nd of 2013, depending on what the laws are. So usually about every 5 years or so, you might want to sit down and just look at your situation and say, we should check in with an attorney, make sure everything is up to date here. And of course, like a lot of things, many people balk at legal expenses. You're probably looking at somewhere between $600 to $1,800 from start to finish for a very thorough estate planning, especially for people with a relatively simple family situation. That might seem like a lot of money. Most people don't want to pay it, but the choice is usually to pay a lawyer a little now or a lot later.
And then a couple of other listeners emailed. They had heard recent segments on finding and paying for health insurance and health care and wanted to put in a vote to check out the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Absolutely. There's an overwhelming amount of information on that website, including what's known as the State Health Insurance Assistance Program, or SHIP. And you can find out not only about health care, but health insurance, different programs available from both government-sponsored and private information as well. And I'll also put in one here, too, that we'll talk a lot about next year. But this is everything that I've seen from this site. I have no connection to them, but this company, out of Illinois called allsup.com, allsup.com. And what they do is they're actually a service that helps Medicare applicants find the best plans for them, whether it's Part A, B, C, D, all the other types of insurance or whatever. And it's a small fee. It's usually $75 to about $395, depending on which one. But you tell the service what you need for health care and where you're at, and they'll give some recommendations back to you. They're not affiliated with any Medicare provider or health provider company. But again, allsup.com will not only be talking more about that next year, but I'll have a link up to that website at onyourmoney.com too.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, you can email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. If we don't get to it today, perhaps we'll get to it on a future program. You can also call 1-800-642-1234. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we are welcoming your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question about personal finances for Kevin. Our first caller is Bill in Keewaskum. Hello, Bill.
Hello. Hello.
Yes, Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
So ask your question, Bill.
Oh, okay. We are about 68 years old right now, my wife and I, and we're getting close to the 70 and a half, of course, where we have to start taking out our retirement money out of our 401k. I'm wondering if we should invest that money in a permanent annuity.
And first, Kevin, I know we've dealt with this issue before, but... For listeners who weren't listening, like Bill in the past, what is an annuity?
It's a contract with an insurance company. Usually, sometimes it means it's just a fixed annuity, like a bond, where the insurance company pays you a fixed interest rate. Other times, it's a variable annuity, which is kind of like a mutual fund within this package. And then finally, there are immediate annuities, and that's the one I'm curious about. Bill, are you thinking about an immediate annuity where you just give the money to an insurance company and then they make a payment to you every single month or so?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would avoid those. We're going to talk about those after the first of the year. It's a great question, and here people like these in some sense because they say, good, as long as the insurance company's around, I get a check every single month as long as I live or as long as my wife lives as well. On the surface, it's understandable why people would like these, but you're actually, if you compare the rates you're probably going to get in terms of the amount of money you're going to get, Bill, every single month, you're actually probably better off just putting the money in a hole in the ground and pulling out the same dollar amount every single month, because at least you'll have access to your principal. So if it were me, I would prefer you avoid an immediate annuity, and then also because you're getting Social Security, correct?
Yes, we are.
Okay. You know, that's also like an immediate... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, but this insurance agent said that we can also draw our principal out of that annuity without...
Go ahead, Kevin.
Without a penalty, you're saying? Like you can pull
right.
The principal out when you feel like it? Yeah. There are a lot of features in a lot of these annuities, and they're very confusing. And I'm guessing this isn't something, Bill, where you approach this agent saying, do you have any annuities? It's something that he probably contacted you and offered you with, correct?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay. And that's common. It doesn't make annuities bad. It just means they're usually sold by people, not bought by people. And so I would be very cautious of it if you were going to do it, Bill, for other listeners out there. I would prefer that you do it with a small portion of the money and make sure that you understand not only the advantages, which are very prominently featured often, but also the downsides and the cost, and say, what is this costing me every single year? If they say nothing, then they are either ignorant about their own product or they're not being fully truthful with you. And if they say, well, you don't pay anything, you only pay if you pull the money out, there's a surrender charge in many annuities that can run anywhere from 5 to 10%, which means, you know, if you pull the principal out within a certain time frame, you do pay a surrender charge on that. That can be pretty hefty. Now, if you're comfortable with all those things and you understand the cost and risk, I'm okay with them. But most people don't, and usually it's so confusing. There's like a, you know, probably a 250-page prospectus, Bill, that you were given by the insurance agent?
Not completely, no. We were just talking about it, okay? All right.
Okay.
I got another question. If I have to draw my 70, at 70 and a half, I have to start taking the money out and paying taxes. Let's say that would it be better to pass that money on in inheritance, just take out the minimum amount and get and pass that on as inheritance then?
Your second question is also a good question. It's probably better off to use it as you see fit and spend it accordingly. And what I'd prefer you do is take out at least the RMD, the required minimum distribution, which starts out at about 3% of the balance of all your retirement accounts in the year you turn 70 and a half, and then goes up about a percentage every single year after that. You can leave the minimum in there, but sometimes there's a danger that you'll pull it out in the future, and if you need a lot of it, you'll pull it out and it'll be taxed at a higher rate, and the people you leave it to might be at a higher income bracket when they pull it out too. So I'd pull it out and spend. Make sure you spend what you need and try to enjoy it while you can, and if it's there for somebody else beyond, so be it.
Thank you very much, Bill, for the call, and good luck to you. Say, Kevin, just curious if you can hear, and that means listeners can also hear the drill and the pounding of nails going on in the studio. I don't know what's going on. They're building something.
Are they building the WPR nativity scene? Are they going to do the live nativity scene this year where people can just walk through and see you and all the other personalities posing?
That's a good idea. I'm not sure what's going on.
Would Rob be the baby in the manger?
He's got the hair for it, maybe.
Yeah, this year. He does.
Yeah, they're building a fort, Bill Martins tells me.
There we go.
There we go. So anyway, please pardon our mess. I guess we're remodeling. I'm not sure. But this is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question about your personal finances or some sort of money matter, it is welcome at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And let's go next to Bill in West Palm Beach, Florida. Well, happy to have you with us, Bill. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. Are you listening online?
Well, I was, and then your screener said, you know what, go to a regular phone.
Yeah, she cracks the whip, I know.
I'm just happy to get through. We've got a condo up in Wisconsin it's paid for, and we've got one down here that isn't. And I'm thinking of a mortgage refinance down here. And what we're paying right now, well, we've got a 30-year on it at 5%. And I've shopped around, and I can get a 15-year at 3.25, closing costs are about $2,000, or I can get a 10-year at 2.59, closing costs are about $3,000. Now, I'm going to be in my 70s or whatever, I'm crossing over like the last gentleman, so I'm facing this mandatory withdrawal. So I guess my question is, should I maybe use the... You got to take 3% out. Should I use maybe all that money coming out and just plow it into the existing mortgage, or maybe make a refi here?
All good questions, Bill. I have one for you before we move on.
Yeah.
How much snow did you get down there yesterday?
Not too bad. I hate to say it. It's been in the 80s.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit, I'm assuming. Are you seeing Fahrenheit? That just sounds awful. Great questions. I prefer you go with a 15-year at 3.25. Here's why. First of all, you save yourself $1,000 in closing costs.
Right.
Second of all, you can always pay that off early if you want to. And if you do pay it off early, let's say you took the 15-year out and then made the payment that would be required of the lower, the 10-year mortgage, Bill,
okay,
you'll probably still pay that off in about 10 and a half years. But if for whatever reason interest rates go up or you need the money for some other purpose that's more urgent than paying off the mortgage on the condo, you'll have it there and you'll have the flexibility to slow down the payments on that. And with a 10-year, you're going to be bunched a little bit closer. And the one other thing I'd be interested in, especially when you're pulling out money from your retirement accounts, if for whatever reason you needed to pull out more than what you would otherwise have to from the required minimum distribution, that could hit you with a much higher tax rate than what you would want to pay. So if you can keep the payment low, you can keep the game going, kick the can down the road for the 30 days, and then you get 30 more days to decide where the next mortgage payment is going to come from. So all of the things being equal, I'd have you get the mortgage, I'd have you get the 15 years, save yourselves $1,000 or so on the closing cost and points, and then just pay it down as slowly as you can. And then if 5 or 6 years go by and you still say, gosh, I've got nothing better to do with this money, then you might want to accelerate the payments and just be done with it. But my guess is you'll probably be happy you locked this in when you did.
Okay, I really appreciate your help. Thanks again.
Thanks, and enjoy your weather, Bill. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us just about every Tuesday at this time with information and advice on your money. And it's time now for our Smart Assets segment of the show. And the year is almost over, but there's still time to make a gift or a donation to your favorite charity or nonprofit, and that's always a good idea. Yes, Kevin?
Yeah, Giving USA says that charitable giving is coming back a little bit, in part because of uncertainty over what the tax laws for 2013 and beyond will bring to us. So people are saying we might lose some of those deductions in the future, so we better take them now by giving money away. Giving USA says that we give about $1,000 or so per person in this country to charitable organizations every single year. And nonprofits, that $1,000 is very generous. It works out to about $20 a week, which is understandable. Wisconsin, though, at least as it's measured by the Chronicle of Philanthropy, does not give a great deal of income. We're very lucky to have very generous listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio, but Wisconsin is ranked 44th in percent of income given to charitable organizations. Not a huge difference. The average is about 4.7% nationwide, and we give about 3.4% of our income. Part of it is our income's a little lower. Also, Bible Belt tends to give a higher percentage just because they give more to their churches and organizations or so. Utah is first, New Hampshire is last on that. But if you are going to express your generosity in a tangible form, we've got a few tips here that you can still get it done this year and get the most bang for your buck.
Well, speaking of bucks, I assume most groups enjoy cash or check.
Yes, most of them definitely will take that and say thank you very much. And that can be the more satisfying, especially I've noticed a lot of people in the past and some clients of mine have kind of gone around the normal tax deductibility and filtering the money through larger organizations. And they're finding smaller groups or even individuals who can receive their money. They don't get a tax break for it, but they find that they get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. If you do want a deduction and you're going to give cash or check, first of all, check out the charity. Make sure that it's a qualified nonprofit. Second of all, you only get the deduction usually if you itemize, and you do need to get a receipt if the gift is more than $250, just so down the road. If you do get an audit, you have some proof of it. Usually the credit card or debit slip can qualify as that paper that the IRS will need to see to guarantee it, but definitely want to put that in your file and save it for later.
And then there are some other more advanced giving methods other than just cash or check?
Yeah, actually, and some of them we've talked about before and we will again. One is to give appreciated stock directly to the charity. And this is if you have it outside of a retirement account. Let's say you bought some shares way back when, transfer them to the charity. You get a deduction for your gift. You don't have to worry about selling them. The charity will do it. You don't have to worry about paying taxes on it. And best of all, for some of these little odd lots of shares you might have accumulated over the years, you don't have to go back and figure out the cost basis for it if it is given to the charity to be sold. Also, we've had a big uptick in interest in donor-advised funds, which are like mini foundations that individuals can set up and get a big tax deduction on their deposit now, but then slowly give out the money in the future years and keep more control over it so that they don't have to decide right now to give a big chunk of money to one organization. And finally, and this is something we'll definitely be focusing on next year, charitable gift annuities, where you give an amount of money to a qualified charity, and you get a tax deduction at the time, and then you get money back for your life or yours or your spouse's or for a period of time that is not only income for you, it's fairly competitive, but also a lot of the income comes back to you in a tax advantage manner as well.
And I do hope that you give to the charity or nonprofit of your choice, a cause that means a lot to you, and I guess if Wisconsin Public Radio is among those causes important to you, it doesn't hurt to get a little plug in, Kevin, for those who would like to contribute to WPR before the end of the year.
Absolutely. If you can stand listening to this show, you must be a huge supporter of Wisconsin Public Radio. So go to WPR.org/support/ to find out information not only on how you can give in the most favorable manner to yourself and help your own situation out, but also sponsorship, donations, and if you want to give of your time, you can find out how to volunteer in your area. Some people I know have someone who they want to, don't really know what to get for them, but they know they're a big fan of public radio or Wisconsin Public Radio, so you can go to that same link and find out how to give a gift membership in Wisconsin Public Radio to that person. And then finally, as you've heard during some of the breaks here, and we'll have a really neat product later on that might be especially suitable for this, if you go to WPR.org and then click on the Amazon.com link, if you do buy something at Amazon and go via that portal from WPR, WPR gets a small portion of your purchase from Amazon, and you don't pay anything more for the particular item. So if you're going to buy it anyway from Amazon, you might as well go through WPR.org first, and then you can help out a little bit without spending or giving any more money.
Very good, and we thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio throughout the year, and thank you in advance if you're deciding to give us some year-end help. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question for certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our next caller related to this segment is Clifford in Green Bay. Hi, Clifford.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, in the past I've given or made a direct transfer of funds from my IRA to a charitable organization to avoid income tax on that. Is that still available this year?
Wonderful, Clifford. Thank you, first of all, for your generosity. Second of all, for bringing that up. Normally, people who were over 70 and a half could transfer their required minimum distribution or more from directly to an IRA and not have to pay taxes on it went through. And this was valuable because a lot of people either don't itemize or can't get the advantage from itemizing, so they couldn't deduct this donation. Strangely enough, Clifford, we're here at December 11th with 20 days to the end of the year, and it doesn't look like that provision will be allowed for 2012. Mm-hmm. Now, there could be some reconciliation with Congress that might allow it to not only be put in place between now and the end of the year, but if I had to guess, I'd say there probably will be something where it won't be put in place by the end of this year, but we might have it back in place for next year. So I'm glad you're thinking of it. It's a very efficient way to give money that you may not necessarily need and still not have to pay taxes on it, and more importantly, have it affect your taxes of your Social Security. So, no, we can't help you out there yet, but stay tuned.
All right. Thank you, Clifford, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I really can't stay.
Well, it is colder outside anyway, and with winter finally here, it's time to start thinking about how to save money on your heating bills. And I bet you, Kevin, you have some good advice along those lines.
Yeah, they say that it's going to be a long winter in Wisconsin. All winters are long.
Mm-hmm.
The typical temperature is actually for December, January, and February, it's usually about a high of 30 and a low of 15 each day. But when it was, 60 degrees almost a few days ago, it really, this kind of drop is not just chilling, but mind-numbing as well. But we do have some great ways to spend a little less money and save some energy as well. And we have them from easy to not so easy. So some things you can do right now after you've done listening to the show. And other things might take a little while longer, but are going to give you much more benefit.
I say let's start with the easy.
I agree with you, path of least resistance. Change your furnace filter. If you can't remember the last time you changed it, it's probably time to change it. And a new furnace filter will save you about $10 per month in heating costs because it does pump the air through more efficiently and the air is cleaner as well. And then during the winter and the summer, and this is the seasonal, December 21st to March 21st, and then June 21st to September 21st, you should change your filter every single month. While you're down there, please note that you probably have not had that furnace serviced in quite some time, and so you definitely want to have that done. And when the temperature really drops like this, like it has a few days, I feel bad. I've been there before, but we see in our neighborhood these, you know, heating and air conditioning trucks driving up, and I know what those people are going through when they wake up and it's 42 degrees in there. Make an appointment now to have your furnace checked, and hopefully that'll avoid an emergency call, because I guarantee the furnace always goes out at the Christmas Eve or the night before you have people over for the holidays or whatever. So definitely get that done now sooner rather than later. And once the person looks at the furnace, he or she might say to you, you know what, this old gal is probably ready for replacement. And if it is, you should know that there are going to be some new rules affecting your furnace replacement.
What do you mean by new rules? What do the new rules do?
They take effect in May of 2013. They come from the Department of Energy. And right now, most people replacing their furnace can get by with an 80% energy efficient furnace. After May 1st of 2013, it requires a 90% energy efficiency, which some people may have to make some special modifications for some side venting to their furnace, especially if it's in an interior room. Usually condos, townhouses, etc. are probably going to suffer from this. Now, a 90% energy efficient furnace saves you about $400 more per year than an 80% does in heating bills, but it is going to cost you maybe a few $1,000s in modifications to get it in. So if you do want to just stick with the 80% one, you probably want to replace it before May 1st of 2013. The other good news is there is help from utilities. They're well aware of this if it is going to affect your situation. And you can get some tax credits as well for replacing the furnace with the high efficiency version.
All right. So where can we find out about these various tax credits or incentives?
Well, even if your furnace is up to date, if you haven't had an energy audit in quite a while, the technology for saving energy and therefore saving money is advancing very rapidly. So it might cost $200 to $400 to have an energy audit. But many utilities in our listening area actually subsidize that energy audit. And even once you find out some things that you can do or should do, the utility will give you either rebates or credits, or you can get some tax credits for making those improvements. Go to focusonenergy.com, focusonenergy.com, to find out if the utility in your area offers you some help on both the audit and any rectifications you need to make with the house. And again, for someone you're trying to say, I don't know what to get this person, or they're on a limited income, an energy audit can go a long way towards not only saving them some money, but saving how much energy they use as well, too.
Well, that's a great idea. Any other tips on saving money on our heating bills?
Yes, and I'm going to report back. We haven't installed this yet, but I'm such a sucker for these things, so I had to get it. The Nest thermostat, N-E-S-T thermostat, and it was described by someone as if Apple computers had designed the thermostat. It's fairly expensive. It's about $250 for the second generation option, but you can control it from your Wi-Fi or your iPhone, your smartphone, and it also senses the temperature in the house, so it can tell if you're there and you have a specific temperature you like. The Nest thermostat will automatically go to that temperature. It will also tell you if you haven't changed the filter in a while, and you can reset it once you change it, so it'll give you an alert that way. And again, it's $250, takes about a half an hour to install. It should save you a lot of money. You'll get the payback within a matter of months. And again, if you do decide to purchase it and you purchase it through Amazon.com, make sure you go through Wisconsin Public Radio to get there, because you'll be giving a few bucks to WPR and not paying any more for the product.
Well, all good information. Thank you, Kevin. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, here to answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Back to the phones, and Paul in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Kevin, my question relates to our caller two callers ago when you talked about the choice between a 10 and a 15-year mortgage. I'm in a similar situation, or was. I'm same age as the fellow, 70 years old. I think that's what he said. Got a pretty high mortgage, about $250. And my person I dealt with at the bank said, are you ever going to pay the house off in your lifetime? I said, no. And she advised me, then why don't you go with a 30-year? Because you're going to cut your payment way down. and the interest rate wasn't that different, 3.3 than a 15. And that made sense to me, and I did it. Did I do the wrong thing?
Absolutely not, Paul. You did the right thing according to the On Your Money dictum of mortgage payments. That is, you take out as much as the lender will allow for as long as the lender will allow, and then pay it back off as slowly as possible. People, we are in a time of extraordinarily low interest rates and relatively easy credit. And if I'm wrong and interest rates go lower and credit gets easier, well, most people will always be able to refinance. But if I'm right and interest rates go up or lenders get tighter on the types of mortgages they'll give, they might start using only adjustable rate mortgages. They might start using mortgages that require you to have 40 or 50% of skin in the game rather than a 10 or 20% down payment, you'll be very happy that you took out as much as you could and then paid it off as slowly as possible. The great thing about this situation, Paul, as you mentioned with the previous caller, with a 30-year mortgage, if you take that out and then make the payment that the 15-year would have required, because I'm guessing, Paul, the payment on the 15-year was a few hundred dollars more per month than the 30-year, correct?
$500 to $700 more.
Okay, it's quite a bit more. If you were to have taken that 30-year out and then made the payment that the 15-year would require, you'd still pay it off within about 15 and a half to 16 years. But if for either a personal or global situation makes you need to lower that payment out, you can, and pay it down as slowly as possible. And I think that's really a great way to go.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that caller, two callers ago, should probably maybe think about the 30-year. He just was talking about a 15 or a 10.
Mm-hmm.
I give you
advice here, Paul. Okay.
Well, he was asking specifically between those two.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
no.
Thank you.
He has a big, good point. Yeah, where he's going to, the gentleman who was calling before to whom Paul refers, one of the issues is he's talking about a condo, and condos are much more difficult to get a straight 30-year fixed-rate mortgage on. Sometimes you can't get any mortgage at all, so it might have been more difficult to get a 30-year, which is why he was talking about a 15. But yeah. Good advice anyway.
Yes, thank you, Paul. I don't mean to get all morbid here, but when Paul says he's not going to pay off his mortgage in his lifetime, that means that he's going to pass away before the 30-year mortgage is up, and then what, the estate just pays for it?
Yeah, typically it comes out of the estate, and mm-hmm. and that mortgage is paid off, or the house is sold off. And you know, even if Paul does live long enough, for most of us, if you're 70 and you have a 30-year mortgage, even if you do outlive the mortgage, you're going to forget you took it out at some point anyway, so it won't be that big of a deal to you.
All right, thanks a lot, Paul, for the call. Patty in South Range is with us now. Hi, Patty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question on, we have children that are 13 and 15, and we have had 529 stocks for them since they've been quite young, and they haven't really done anything. So I switched to a stock company to get kind of a more balanced approach to their college. And I'm wondering if that was the right thing to do, because I don't know how they will apply for financial aid. We're the custodians of the stocks.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, Patty, the money's not in a 529 anymore?
No, we did leave it in the 529. We just didn't add any more to it because with the economy the way it's been, it hasn't done very well. It hasn't been the be-all and end-all that they promised it to be.
Sure, it's a good way to save, but it's only as good as the actual underlying investment, much like a 401k or mutual fund or whatever. And so now you started saving money for kids, but it's in the kids' name where you're the custodian of the account, and then the kids will get the money at some point?
Yeah, and it's just like a power company stock. It's just a slow, steady growth.
So,
and I'm just not sure now if that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I'm not averse to doing what you did. Slow, steady it is growth. It, many people will tell you power companies, utility stocks can be a great long-term investment. They can also lose money as well. So don't be lulled into a false sense of security with that. That said, typically here is how assets are attached by schools when they're calculating what is known as the expected family contribution. They start with the kids' earnings. That gets the biggest chunk. And then money in the kid's name, usually about a third or so of any money in the kid's name will be put into the equation each year. And so let's say there's $10,000 in the kid's name, then you might see about $3,000 go into the expected family contribution of the total cost before any need-based aid is awarded. I don't dislike what you did, Patty. I wouldn't want you to put any more money in there. And the reason being is not so much about financial aid. Most aid is need-based, and it usually comes in the form of loans, not grants, and so there's not a ton of free money that doesn't have to be paid back out there. What I'm more concerned about are, first of all, the tax implications. UTMA accounts have a lot of ever-changing details that need to be taken care of for tax purposes. And what's a bigger concern of mine is that is really the kids' money. And technically, by the letter of the law, you have to give it to them when they're 18 or 21, depending on the state in which the account is registered. And so they can do with that money whatever they want. Now, the smart thing to do is just not tell them about it. But if they know that it's there and they want to get their hands on it, they can, and they can spend it however they want as well. So in the future, I prefer most people use 529 solely because it allows you to keep more control over the money. And yes, they might not make a whole lot in the next few years, but at least the money is sheltered. Any earnings are sheltered from taxes, and the parent or grandparent or whomever keeps total control over it and only doles it out when they see fit.
Thank you very much, Patty, for calling. Siegfried in Racine is with us now. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, I've got a quick question. All other things being equal, when you're 62, is it better to take out early Social Security or to take an annuity and tide you over to 66?
All right, I'm
great
so sorry.
Questions. Yeah, this is what all of Wisconsin sounds like right now, Siegfried. Everyone is just apologizing for their hacking, and it's just part of living above the...
Yeah, that's right. We understood, though.
Completely. Oh, yeah, we speak winter Wisconsinese, definitely. Siegfried, my preference for most people is to actually take Social Security and pension sooner rather than later for several reasons. The first one being is that you have to live to be about 78 to 80 to make it break even, to make waiting make sense. And a lot of us obviously won't live that long. Second thing is if you draw down your savings and live off of it for the supposed higher check down the road, that only, not only depletes your savings for an emergency, but also depletes your savings so if maybe interest rates go up in the future, you might be able to get a CD or savings bond or something that pays you a much higher interest rate. And if you've already spent all that money, you obviously can't put it to work. And the third thing being is people transition, and most of the people I work with, Siegfried, are in the situation where they're retiring and moving from working and saving into retiring and spending. And yes, on paper, it's easy for people to see why drawing off of their savings for a while and delaying payments makes sense. But emotionally, it's very difficult to just deplete your savings rapidly in retirement while you're waiting for this thing that's going to allegedly be more down the road. And every time you turn on the radio or the TV or read a newspaper or go online, you hear things about why this check actually isn't going to be there anyway. So I'd much rather have people take Social Security sooner rather than later and have them replace that paycheck that most people give up at 62 or whatever age. It's easier to handle, and it's safer to keep those savings set aside for emergencies or better investment opportunities in the future.
All right. Thank you, Siegfried. Hope you feel better. Dawn emails, how can we determine if we need life insurance? I'm 60. My husband is 66 and soon to retire. Term insurance is expensive. What about first-to-die insurance? Or would we be better off spending the money on long-term care insurance?
Yeah, we'll be covering that in future shows. But I would say that if for whatever reason you are not going to have at least 200 times your net monthly expenses in liquid assets, you might want to look at either keeping insurance policies you have or going out to find a new one. And especially since if one person dies, usually that person's or the higher Social Security check disappears, as does the lower Social Security check, rather, and also maybe a pension check. So that's one reason to keep insurance not only in force, but go out and look at a new policy. And Dawn, I'd rather have you have life insurance than long-term care insurance. And we'll talk about that after the first of the year.
Yeah, sounds good. So the time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Yes, we've covered lots of great places to go for good gifts. This one will help you find the right gift for that person, wantful.com, W-A-N-T-F-U-L. .com. Once again, proving that all of the good domain names are taken. Wantful.com will ask a few questions of you about the person for whom you are getting the gift, price range, interest, age, gender, whatever, and then spit back some gifts that people in that same demographic have liked. And then you can decide if it's something you want to purchase and then go through and click through right away. Wantful.com, and we'll have that link up to our, at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, I hope a snowblower or the neighbor kid is in your future, Kevin. So, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, joining us from our studios in Eau Claire, where they got about 15 inches of snow. Thanks very much to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. And I hope you're with us tomorrow at this time. We're going to be taking a look at pop culture history in the United States and how Elvis, Oprah, and other icons help shape who we are today and what they say about our American society. That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.